In the preceding lecture, I endeavored to give you a general view of the nature of theology and pointed out its superiority to every other subject of study. As it treats of God and divine things, of our duty and our hopes, it is equally interesting to the learned and the unlearned. I showed you that it is distinguished into natural and supernatural or revealed theology, and that of the latter there are three divisions, didactic, polemic, and practical theology. Didactic theology explains the doctrines of religion and states the proofs or the arguments by which their truth is evinced. Polemic theology considers the controversies respecting those doctrines and replies to the objections of adversaries. It is the business of practical theology to point out the improvement which should be made of the doctrines by detailing the duties incumbent upon those who profess to receive them as true and the motives which they supply to the faithful performance of these duties. I concluded by laying before you some of the qualifications for the study of theology, and I mentioned piety, without which the study, if not unsuccessful, will certainly be unprofitable, a competent share of human learning, which is indispensably necessary to eminence in your profession, and the love of truth, or a sincere desire to know the will of God, leading to candor, diligence in your inquiries. Let us now proceed to inquire what are the sources of theology, or, in other words, what are the sources from which our knowledge of it is derived. These are reason and revelation. Here, our attention is demanded to such questions as these, whether reason and revelation are both necessary. If only one, whether is it reason or revelation? And lastly, if reason alone is insufficient, how far its discoveries extend, and what are its defects which are supplied by revelation? Reason signifies in this place the intellectual and moral faculties of man exercised without any supernatural assistance in the investigation of religion. Whether under its guidance he can attain all the knowledge which is necessary to conduct him to virtue and happiness is the great subject of controversy between infidels and Christians. There is another dispute among Christians themselves with respect to the degree of its ability. While some maintain that it can discover the doctrines of what is called natural religion, others affirm that these could not be known without the aid of revelation. Nothing is more unphilosophical and a more certain source of error than to indulge in vague speculations and barren generalities upon any subject, when it is in our power to enter into a close investigation of it, and to bring it to the test of experience. It is easy to present to us a system of religion containing a variety of articles supported by a train of arguments which seem to amount to demonstration, and to tell us that reason, being the gift of God, must be perfectly sufficient to direct men in all the parts of their duty, that religion being a general concern, they would not be responsible unless they were all furnished with the means of acquiring the knowledge of it, that the supposition of supplementary means is a reflection upon the wisdom of God, as if he had not originally adapted man to his situation, and was hence compelled to devise a new expedient for correcting the error. Without examining these assertions one by one, and showing, which we might do, that they are mere gratuitous assumptions, it may suffice to observe that not a single fact in the history of mankind can be adduced in confirmation of them. They are an utopian description of an imaginary state, not a sober relation of things which really exist. They are a priori arguments, or arguments deduced from our own previous conceptions, not arguments a posteriori, or founded on observation and experience. The question is not what should be according to our ideas of justice and fitness, but what actually is, not what purposes reason abstractly considered may be presumed to accomplish, but what purposes reason as existing in men is found to have actually accomplished. It is preposterous, first, to give an arbitrary definition of reason, and then to conclude that it is capable of exerting all the power which we have been pleased to ascribe to it. It is more consonant to sound philosophy to judge of the power of reason by its effects. In a word, we must not waste our time and impose upon ourselves by endeavoring to show beforehand what reason can do. We ought to proceed according to a different and a safer plan and inquire what it has actually done. It may be proper to remark that there are two senses in which reason may be understood, and consequently that what is true of it in one sense may not be true in another. First, reason may signify the high intellectual ability with which man was endowed at his creation, and which we may conceive to have been as sufficient to direct him in his original state as instinct is to direct the lower animals, both being perfect in their kind. I would not affirm, however, that even then reason was his only guide, because it appears from the sacred history that he lived in familiar intercourse with his Maker, and was favored with occasional communications of his will. Secondly, reason may signify the intellectual powers of man in his present state, when he feels the effects of the fall in all his faculties, and both his mind and conscience are defiled. It is with reason in this sense alone that we have at present to do. It is no more an impeachment of the wisdom and goodness of God to affirm the incompetence of corrupt reason in matters of religion than it is to say that an eye which in consequence of disease does not see at all, or sees imperfectly, is unfit for the purpose which it was originally intended to serve. From the preceding observations, we perceive that it is not from theory, but from experiment, not from conjecture, but from fact, that we can ascertain what assistance may be expected from reason in the study of theology. Let us then review some of the doctrines of what is called natural religion, and is supposed properly to lie within the province of reason, that we may see what has been the result of its researches. The first principle of religion is the existence of God, who made us, and to whom we owe homage and obedience. No doubt seems to be entertained that this fundamental truth is demonstrable by reason, and accordingly there are many books in which it is evinced by arguments so strong and conclusive that it is not easy to conceive how any man who has attended to them can continue an atheist. The metaphysician, we should think, would be overpowered by the profound reasonings of Clark, and the man of a plainer understanding by the more obvious proofs collected in the writings of Ray and Durham and Paley. There is one thing which ought not to be overlooked, that this triumphant demonstration, as it may be justly called, is found only in the writings of Christians. For although a similar train was pursued by some of the heathen philosophers, as Cicero in his work concerning the nature of the gods and Socrates in the dialogues of Xenophon, the illustration was not so ample as it is now made by the discoveries of modern philosophy, nor was the conclusion to which it naturally led drawn with equal clearness and confidence. The cause of this difference we are at no loss to divine. To the Gentiles, the existence of God was a point involved in doubt, an inference to be deduced from premises, and they who saw some steps of the process were not always able to see with equal distinctness the result. When Christians sit down to discuss the subject, they are fully convinced of the fact, and how different it is to discover an unknown truth by a slow induction of particulars, and to find out proofs of a truth already admitted. How much easier the one process is than the other, you will perceive upon the slightest reflection. The former is like the voyage of Columbus, who did not know whether there was a country as America, and had nothing but probability to support him amidst the difficulties and perils of the enterprise. The latter is like the same voyage now, when the place being known, the sailor can shape his course to it by his chart and compass. Nature, it is acknowledged, cries aloud in all her works that there is a God. But she spoke in vain, as a late writer observes, to the sages of antiquity, who either altogether failed to interpret her language, or suffered the still whisper of divine philosophy to be lost amidst the various bustle of the world. The ancients, imperfect as their sciences were, knew more than enough of the harmony and design of the universe to draw out an unanswerable argument from final causes, and in point of fact they did draw out both that and other arguments, so far as to leave us an indisputable proof that the God of natural theology will never be anything more than the dumb idol of philosophy, neglected by the philosopher himself, and unknown to the multitude, acknowledged in the closet and forgotten in the world. This truth made no impression upon their minds, and it is not surprising that it did not, as their notions of it were exceedingly imperfect and erroneous. The idea of what has been called the personality of the deity, or his distinct subsistence, was in a great measure unknown to them. The deity was considered not so much an intelligent being as an animating power diffused throughout the world, and was introduced into their speculative system to account for the motion of that passive mass of matter which was supposed coeval and coexisting with himself. In practice, they adopted the polytheism of their country, and paid religious honors to the endless train of gods and goddesses who were acknowledged by the vulgar. There was not a nation upon earth but the Jews, in which the living and true God was adored. Every object was mistaken for him, Every part of the universe was deified, and fancy exerted its creative power in superadding a multitude of imaginary beings, insomuch that the gods of Greece, that seat of refinement and philosophy, amounted to 30,000. In modern India, where science has long been cultivated, the number is still greater, and we are astonished at the information that its gods are estimated by millions. Such are the achievements of reason with respect to the first principle of religion.